You don't want somebody, for example, to come into the arms of the criminal justice system to access mental health care. And yet, in many places, that seems to be happening more and more, the criminalization of mentally ill folks with mental illness.
Hi, I'm Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. You are listening to Into the Fold, the Hogg Foundation podcast. Hogg Foundation is a mental health grant-making foundation and part of the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more about the history of the foundation, our grant programs, and the many exciting things that we have got on the horizon this year, visit our website at www.hogg.utexas.edu. So today, we thought we would take this opportunity to discuss an important issue, forensic mental health. Just to give a quick Webster's definition, forensic mental health services are those that are received on the orders of a judge or court as part of a legal proceeding. Sounds simple, but as with so much concerning mental health, doing so in a way that's evidence-based and cost-effective and protective of people's rights and protective of their mental health turns out to be a very complicated business indeed, and especially when, you know, the criminal justice system is an aggravating factor. And so with us today to help bring clarity to this issue are two experts. Neil Goensmith is a professor at the University of Denver's Graduate School of Professional Psychology and teaches in the Forensic Psychology Graduate Program. He created and became the director of the department's Denver First Forensic Mental Health Institute in 2014. Larry Fitch, a clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Maryland Medical School, as well as a professor of law at the University of Maryland Law School. Neil, Larry, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be here.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, so let's just dive right in. In the broadest sense, what does the phrase forensic mental health encapsulate? What are the guiding philosophies? And I guess part two of this, and either of you can take your best shot at any part of the question, what pieces are essential to ensure effective and efficient forensic mental health services?
It's a big question. But forensic basically means for the court, as you suggested earlier. So these are services, mental health services, in cases in the criminal courts, typically involving people with mental disabilities, typically where there's a psycho-legal question that's been raised, you know, whether the individual who's charged with the crime may be incompetent to stand trial. Anyone has the right to a trial. They have a right to a lawyer. All kinds of rights, and if they can't exercise those rights in a meaningful way, the law would say they can't be tried. And in some cases with people with mental disabilities, that compromises their ability to understand what's going on well enough to participate in their case in a meaningful way. The insanity defense is the other issue that comes up with some frequency, where the question is not so much triability as culpability, whether someone should be seen as not responsible for their crime, because the symptoms of their mental disorder caused them not to appreciate, to understand that they were doing something that was wrongful, or that caused them not to be able to control their behavior at the time. And those are the big issues that we think of when we talk about sort of the mainstream of forensic services. But really, it encompasses sort of more than that. You know, services for anyone who gets caught up in the criminal justice system, who has a behavioral health problem, and there may be the opportunity for intervention even before these questions are raised.
I would add to that, Ike, what you're looking at is a system, a network of disciplines, professionals, all along the continuum for which forensic mental health is going to become an issue. So right from the very beginning, community mental health resources, families, educators, friends, teachers, those folks who are starting to recognize warning signs that something may be going on. If the police eventually get involved, then obviously law enforcement is going to be an important part of the puzzle. And then the court systems, how they manage folks with mental health issues, going on into jails, prisons, and psychiatric hospitals, as well as community alternatives to those places. And then at the back end, when folks are coming out of jails or out of prisons or out of hospitals, what are the community resources, what's the safety net that exists in the community to bring those folks back into the community and ensure that they're going to be safe and healthy. And so you're looking at a broad system of people and disciplines who are all trying to figure out this very complicated puzzle together, sometimes without adequate training, sometimes without knowing what the other folks in the system are doing. And so it makes it a very difficult system to navigate.
And ideally with some sort of administrative structure to sort of coordinate all of this, because, you know, we're looking at different agencies across systems, you know, the courts, the jails, mental health agencies, state hospitals. And I know that Texas is going down this road now with hiring someone who's going to be a freestanding forensic director to help in the coordination of these services.
So my next question is, like, what is the relationship between forensic mental health and, I guess, the new emphasis on jail diversion? And how is the field being influenced by kind of the larger discussion that's now happening around mental health and incarceration?
I can start with that. This is Neil. And it's easy to know who's who, because if it's something smart, then Larry's probably said it. So bear with me now that I'm going to talk for a moment. So forensic mental health and jail diversion, it's a larger issue. What we're trying to figure out, jail diversion is one piece of the puzzle to try to do something different with an offender with mental health problems. So there is a model out there called the sequential intercept model. It's not the only model, but it's a nice one that kind of maps out, here's the sequential process for criminal involvement: contact with police, then court hearings, then potential jail time, then potential release time back to the community on parole. And it follows a logical sequence. They call it the sequential intercept model because along the way there are points that you can intercept the traditional kind of model, that linear model, to do something different with an offender with mental health problems. Jail diversion being one of those kind of early interventions that you can do rather than shunting the person into jail and kind of keeping them there for their length of sentence. You might be able to pull them out into the community, put them in a broader system of mental health resources such that they're safe and they don't warrant or need that kind of level of involvement in a jail. But it's a larger conversation, right, when you're looking at not just jail diversion, but lots of other pieces along the way. What can police officers do to recognize and identify warning signs or symptoms of mental health problems? And what resources do they have at their disposal to take the person to rather than maybe arresting the person? What options do the courts have besides jail diversion? There could be mental health court or other kinds of options. What kinds of programs exist within jails and prisons to identify and treat folks with mental health problems? So forth, you know, so on and so forth down the chain there.
To address really the much larger problem of people with mental disabilities caught up in the criminal justice system, we look at the insanity defense, and there are only just a handful of people each year who meet the very strict legal standards for non-responsibility, and although the numbers of folks who are found to be incompetent to stand trial is much larger, it still dwarfs the number of folks who have a, you know, a serious mental disability and encounter the criminal justice system. So there's been a lot of emphasis in recent years on trying to build programs, again, to intercept and divert folks into services. And if they aren't divertible because their charges are more serious, to get them services while they're, you know, incarcerated, confined, and importantly, to help them then reintegrate when they leave. Studies have shown that up to about 16% of people in jails and prisons have a serious mental illness. And it's pretty large numbers, whereas, you know, the mainstream of forensic services, when we're looking at questions like competence to stand trial and the insanity defense, they really address a small number. So there's an important role for providers and others to play in working with the criminal justice system to identify people and to divert them to services that more directly address their needs.
What's tough, though, Ike, is that historically, mental health was never designed to work with criminals, and the criminal justice system was never designed to work with folks with mental illness. Those were not sort of the origins of those different disciplines, and yet here they are inextricably interwoven now. You're seeing many more people with mental illness coming into the criminal justice system, and so you can't tease those apart. You can't take them apart anymore, and yet you still want to maintain not just the expertise of those different disciplines, but really the roles of those different disciplines, because the court and criminal justice have got a discrete a role to play when the person with mental illness is committing a crime, and the role of mental health has got a discrete set of functions that it should serve in that purpose. And sometimes they're even good-naturedly becoming sort of mixed over, and you don't want that to happen in the sense that, and I know Larry can speak very knowledgeably about this, you don't want somebody, for example, to come into the arms of the criminal justice system to access mental health care. And yet, in many places, that seems to be happening more and more, the criminalization of mentally ill folks with mental illness, where a person may be adjudicated as incompetent to proceed, sort of as a backdoor to mental health services, and then they're sort of gliding past the actual role of the court and the judicial process there in sometimes a good-natured or good, well-intentioned way to access mental health services. But that should not be sort of happening in a system that's designed well.
Okay, so we've established that when we're talking about forensic mental health. Very often it is about restoring the competency of individuals so that they can stand trial. And this is under the rules of our Constitution. And there are, in essence, two approaches to competency restoration, inpatient and outpatient. It seems like we're hearing more and more about outpatient, competency restoration. So one thing that I was wondering is what models for that exist, and how effective are those types of programs?
Neil has done some wonderful research on this. I'd just say by way of introduction that historically, all these folks went into state hospitals. And there was a study done back in the 70s that found that more people admitted to Bridgewater State Hospital in Massachusetts, their forensic hospital, as incompetent to stand trial, left the hospital by reason of death than by reason of return to court. They were found incompetent, they were shuttled off to the hospital, and that's where they lived out their lives. That's begun to change, and these newer approaches that Neil will talk about show terrific promise.
That's exactly right. So nationally speaking, there's around 16 different states that actually have current formalized outpatient competency restoration programs in place. There are far more states that have a statutory allowance for it. 40 plus states have statutes that read in such a way that the person could be released to an outpatient facility or outpatient program for competency restoration. But most states don't have that in place. So what we're talking about are folks who have been accused of a crime and are coming to court and don't sort of have the mental capacities to exercise their rights at court and maybe have a general understanding of what's going on at court. And so they're ordered for an evaluation of competency to proceed or competency to stand trial and then adjudicated at some point later in the process as being incompetent and then ordered for restoration. So just setting the stage there, where does that restoration occur? As Larry said, default, historically, it's been state hospitals, but now about 16 states have formalized programs in place, and the programs that are in place work quite well. The rates of restoration, the success rates are about equivalent for inpatient versus outpatient programs. The level of problems that you see in those programs, a person could run away, a person commit a new crime, a person could become violent, those rates are very, very low, and what you see is, if anything, when those things start to bubble up, the person is returned to an inpatient facility. So you're not seeing a lot of negative fallout for it. And obviously they're much cheaper. State hospital beds are precious. They're very expensive. And so by creating sort of a release valve at the front door, what you're doing is, being a better shepherd of taxpayer resources in those kind of precious hospital beds to make sure that the folks who really warrant and need inpatient hospitalization are prioritized for it.
And it's much more respectful of the rights of the individuals as well. Often the charges these folks face are minor charges, and they may be in hospital for much longer than they would have been in jail had they simply pled guilty. So this gives folks an opportunity to return home, get the services they need in a setting that works that's as effective, much more efficiently, as Neil said, frees up the beds for all those other folks who have a need for hospital level of care.
Okay, and so one thing that I was wondering is, how similar are the standards for commitment, for competency restoration versus like ordinary civil commitment, where a person is deemed a threat to themselves or other people.
You know, it's a very good question, and it varies from state to state. But in most states, it's a lot easier to commit someone who's been found to be incompetent to stand trial. The law in most states simply says that upon a finding that a defendant is incompetent to stand trial, the court may, or in some states shall, order the defendant to a hospital for services to restore their competence to stand trial. Standard for civil commitment typically requires showing that someone is sort of eminently dangerous because of the symptoms of a mental illness. So, you know, conceivably, you could have someone who's incompetent to stand trial who does not have a mental illness but is incompetent for other reasons, may be subject to a commitment simply on a finding that they're incompetent to stand trial. And so what it leads to in many states is really an inappropriate use of beds designed for the treatment of people with, you know, serious psychiatric illness that requires hospital-level care, serving people whose needs are not so great. And really at the expense of services for other people who may be waiting in jail for a bed to open up.
Just to add a little bit there, I did some consultation with the state of Washington as they're trying to work through this issue. And one of the things that they were kicking around was a shorter time frame for doing the evaluations of competency to stand trial and trying to get evaluations done in a very tight window. And one of the issues that was discussed during the court proceedings was how much more difficult is it to do a competency evaluation than a civil commitment evaluation? You know, we can turn civil commitment evaluations around very quickly, and we can get the folks into treatment where they belong. Why can't we do the same thing for competency? And I believe the answer is that it's a much more complicated question. It's a psycho-legal question when you're looking at competency that requires more history, more records, more evaluation than a more simple yet still really meaningful discussion of is the person eminently dangerous to self or others.
Okay.
But it is interesting, and I think one of the implications of your question is that, and we're seeing this in many states, is that the courts are looking to competency to stand trial as a vehicle for moving people who they perceive to be mentally ill in jail from the jail to a hospital for treatment because it's easier for the courts, at least, than to go through a process of civil commitment. But again, you know, the results are not always, they're always are imperfect, I would say.
Okay. And so what happens when a defendant is found unrestorable? And what are the best and worst case scenarios for such an individual?
Well, it's interesting. I was involved in a survey about a year ago looking at how that's handled around the country. And the law says, you know, for the last 40 years, the law has said, the Supreme Court has said, on equal protection grounds, that if someone is incompetent to stand trial, can't be tried, but does not meet, is not seen as someone who's likely to be restored to competency in the foreseeable future, then you can't justify a special commitment for purposes of competency restoration. The person would have to be released from the hospital or civilly committed. You can justify civil commitment just like you can for anyone else who may meet the standards for civil commitment, but you can't justify a special commitment for someone who, in fact, is not likely to benefit from that commitment and become competent to stand trial. So the question is, how's that operationalized around the country? And for many years, you know, practically, states ignored it. People were committed as incompetent to stand trial, and they would spend decades, in some cases, hospitalized ostensibly for treatment to restore their competence to stand trial. That's begun to change. And in most states now, the courts at some point will entertain a motion, usually from the defense lawyer, of a finding that the defendant, the person who's charged with the crime and is incompetent to stand trial, is unrestorable and must be moved from that commitment to a civil commitment. But the reality is, in many states, including Texas, the judges may be not so enthused about that and will retain the authority to make the decision when the person is going to be released from their civil commitment. They may convert the commitment from a commitment for restoration to a civil commitment if the person meets the standards for the civil commitment, but will retain the authority to deny the person's release when the hospital feels they're ready to leave.
So, in a couple of different examples, you take a person with dementia, and it's not going to change. It's permanent dementia. It's only going to get worse. If the person is not competent, you know, after their arrest, then competency restoration is unlikely to restore a person with advanced Alzheimer's. It's just not going to happen. And so the court is faced with this dilemma. What should we do? How long should we try? Because as Larry said, as soon as the court finds them unlikely or unrestorable, the criminal charges are essentially dropped and it moves into a civil commitment kind of arena. Do we still have the grounds? Is the person eminently dangerous enough that we're going to keep them in the hospital? But the court does lose control of the case. The prosecutor doesn't like that either. And so in the case of a person with dementia, it's an easier sell. But you get some folks with, you know, advanced mental health problems that are sort of intractable, whether that be psychosis or bipolar symptoms. And it's a more difficult sell and a lot more unease with the court about saying, this is a person who may have committed a very serious crime and they may come around at some point. They may actually respond to medication or there may be a treatment down the road that does make a difference. And so how long do we wait for that to happen? And if we lose control of that case and then they don't meet the civil commitment criteria, this you could be potentially releasing a what could be a dangerous person back to the community.
Right. So as to this issue of assessing danger, what role does risk assessment play in forensic mental health? And in your opinion, how ought it work?
Well, let me hit that first. And I know Neil has some thoughts on this that may be slightly different from mine. But, you know, there are approaches now to assessing risk for violence that are research-based. And then focus on what actuarially, you know, kind of factors that correlate with an increased risk for violence. The problem is most of those factors, nearly all of those factors, have nothing to do with serious mental illness. So when we're talking about, you know, whether someone ought to remain in a clinical setting, in a hospital, for example, where typically, you know, the question is whether the individual presents a risk of harm due to a mental disorder, then if we use these instruments and we identify this person at increased risk for factors not related to a serious mental disorder, what do we do with that individual? And no one wants to release someone who's at high risk for violence. But at the same time, a person really shouldn't be kept in a clinical environment if the risks they present have nothing to do with their illness and they don't otherwise need hospital-level care.
So I understand the legal parameters of it, but clinically speaking, it is a tough sell sometimes to sort of say, well, we need to release this person who's dangerous because the danger isn't stemming from mental health issues. And we know that when we use those actuarial measures as well as the more current structured professional judgment assessment, risk assessment measures, which incorporate a lot of those actuarial variables but more in a clinical context, we generally get it right. You know, the prediction is pretty good about whether somebody is going to be violent, and it even translates over to rehospitalization. So we did a study, for many years I was the chief of forensic services for the state of Hawaii, and we looked at those folks who had been released from the Hawaii State Hospital on an insanity commitment after being found not guilty by reason of insanity, stabilizing the hospital, and then being released to the community. And we followed them, and we looked at the recommendations of the evaluators who had been making the recommendations to the court as to whether or not a person should be released. And the folks that used the actuarial measures got it right more often. I mean, they did. They got it right about 90% of the time compared to kind of the 60-ish percent of the time for the folks who didn't use the measures. They do improve our kind of predictive validity.
One problem with all of this, though, is that, you know, the factors that tend to elevate risk, they tend to be factors that are difficult to address with treatment. You know, people's character doesn't really change, and personality. And those are the factors that so often, you know, drive dangerousness. You know, the idea, the notion of psychopathy. There's even one of the instruments is called the psychopathy checklist, looking at the degree to which a person is psychopathic. And that's not something treatment is very good at. So if you've got someone who's at high risk for that reason, what do you do with the person? Do they stay in a psychiatric hospital? They came into the psychiatric hospital not for that reason. They came in because they committed a crime, for example, driven by illness. The illness now is in check. Those symptoms are in remission. They're no longer having those kinds of thoughts. Can we really justify, though, holding this person, even though their risk for doing that sort of thing for those reasons is very low?
So, but the counterpoint to me is, you know, I teach in a forensic psychology program, and what I try overall to impart to my students is an understanding of how those criminogenic factors and those actuarial factors can be mitigated and changed through good mental health approach. So some of those actuarial factors or criminogenic factors might be employment, might be education, it might be sort of relationships with family. Well, if your symptoms of mental health are impacting your ability to hold a job. If you can't hold a job because the voices are too strong, or if you're not able to have good relationships with your parents or your spouse because your behavior is so dysregulated, well, there's a role for mental health to be able to help you develop the skills and the mechanisms to be able to manage those symptoms in a way that you can hold a job, you can go to school, or you can maintain those relationships, and therefore I think that reduces your risk.
Okay, I think that's kind of a perfect setup for the next question, and it's one of these compound meta questions that I really, really like. So we're talking about the criminal justice system, and in particular individuals who are accused, and let's say in a majority of cases factually guilty of having committed crimes. So how hard is it to keep competency restoration from morphing into either prison or a kind of prison term, or I guess in the case of outpatient competency restoration, a kind of probation, even though we're talking about people whose cases haven't yet been adjudicated? And can we have the best of both worlds, respecting people's rights while at the same time kind of acquiescing to the system's need for a healthy person to stand trial? And does anybody really do this well, in your opinions?
That's a really complex question. I'm going to have Larry answer that one first, because I know that there's maybe some differences there too. But I have learned a lot from Larry's perspective on this and sort of moved my own metric on it a little bit.
Well, in my sense, it really depends on how it's done.
Yeah.
And in some places I know, places that I have had experience with, it's done as you described. Ostensibly the question is this individual's triability. We're trying to protect this defendant's rights to a fair trial. And yet the consequence of a finding of incompetence is placement in treatment that it becomes lengthy. And at some point the person may be released to the community, still incompetent to stand trial, monitored for compliance with an array of services that may look very much like the kinds of services that would be ordered by the court had the individual been convicted of the crime and placed on probation. And they must comply, or they can be violated and returned to confinement. And this can go on for an extended period of time. And at some point, it's then not so much about protecting this individual's rights and making sure that we aren't proceeding against someone who's incompetent. It really becomes more in effect disposition of the case. On the other hand, if competency restoration really is focused on the kinds of services will help this person return to court and participate in their case, and it's time limited so that at some point you recognize this isn't working, then we abandon that and we move to other measures, then I think it can be really effective. And this is the challenge, I think, for systems, is to put up programs that are, community-based to avoid the misuse of beds, but that are focused to avoid the risk that, this whole process will be misused that way.
I think the trick is it's a really tough one. I appreciate what Larry is getting at, and legally there's no argument there whatsoever. But clinically, when you're working with people, you know that wraparound services will help their chances, and you know that a more robust kind of system or array of care is going to not only improve their mental health care, but also probably mitigate against future criminal activity. And so this is the struggle for me, is trying to find the sweet spot in which those resources are available but not necessarily mandated under the criminal context. So when we built the outpatient competency restoration program in Hawaii, it included housing, it included substance abuse treatment, it included trips to the mental health center, not just the competency restoration kind of discreetly compartmentalized. It was a whole host of services. And I spoke with Larry about this and did sort of move my needle a little bit in understanding what you've effectively done is ordered them to a robust system of care when you really should be doing competency restoration. I still feel that there's more clinically that should be done for these folks because they have unwittingly fallen through the cracks before and found themselves in this situation. You don't want that cycle to be repeated. So now at the University of Denver, when we've created an outpatient competency restoration program there, it really is much more narrowly focused on just competency restoration.
But it's a laudable sentiment, to want to do, provide the full array of services someone needs. And ideally, the person will recognize this is in their interest and will, embrace it. So many defendants don't want anything to do with this system, and they're charged with the crime, and it may be a minor crime, and they never had a chance for trial, and suddenly now they're under orders to comply with a full array of things that are things they don't want. So, you know, as a lawyer, it bothers me from a sort of a due process perspective. At the same time, I recognize how valuable it can be in helping the individual get on with their lives.
Okay. So here in my great state of Texas, we have just enacted legislation, Senate Bill 1507, among other things, it establishes a forensic director position at our Department of State Health Services. And so I guess my last question is that if you had this person's ear, and you know, you don't have to pretend any deep knowledge about how things work in Texas, but you know, any little bit that you do know is germane, I think. What would we be doing more of? What would we be doing less of?
I'll start the law. So yeah. We actually did have her ear last night over barbecue, and the barbecue here is a lot better than Colorado, and I think Maryland too. So it was a that was a treat. And I mentioned two things to her that I think are really key. One is to ensure that you're getting input and perspectives from around the state and the diverse amount of stakeholders that are represented. So law enforcement, corrections, judiciary, mental health, families, peers. You want the whole array of folks being in that conversation to help make a system sort of informed by all sectors, but not just listening. You want to make sure that you have some sort of committee, some sort of department that's not just a lone wolf or lone voice that she is going to represent in the state of Texas. You want her to have a wider kind of net that has some decision-making power associated with it, so she really can enact some things that are important. But the second major thing I was telling her is that you want to make sure that you are changing the culture that I think exists in Texas and other states where hospitalization is sort of the default, and moving it away from being the sort of traditional default to an option, and an option for folks that really require or merit hospitalization. And so developing community-based resources and alternatives along that sequential intercept model that maybe can be used to limit how often the hospital is used inappropriately.
And on this, Neil and I are in complete agreement, and it's so true. There's an opportunity for the person in Texas who's going to be overseeing forensic services to network with people who do this work in other states who've been dealing with these very issues for many years. And again, you have to coordinate the folks in Texas who are providing services to this population, not just services, you know, the folks who operate the jails, law enforcement, and all the rest. Need to be kind of seen from the same page. And I think really, in so many respects, that's the role of the forensic director, to have sufficient autonomy to do this interagency way statewide.
Okay, great. Neil Gowan-Smith, Larry Fitch, thanks so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedules to drop some wisdom on our audience. And this is a complicated issue, but an important one. And I, you know, from my standpoint, just imagining all the different ways that a person can find themselves caught up in some of the very fraught dynamics that you guys have been talking about. So it's good that we could get you here. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.